This week, the general election. Oh, that's quite hard to say, isn't it?
Nope.
The CMU podcast, in association with Seven Digital.
This week, the general election, Prince and Festival Republic. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. With me, as he so often is, it's Chris Cook. Hello, Chris Cook.
Hello there.
Hi. We weren't here last week,
but we
did hear your voice, but a weird presenter voice, which I'm assuming everyone found very confusing and upsetting.
Well, you're the one who pushed it out onto the podcast feed, so you're referring to the fact that the head of The Great Escape, which was last week. I was on stage quite a lot for the 2 days, so if you were there, you probably heard me speaking. But prior to the event kicking off, we did a little sort of overview of the last year in the music business, which we used to do at 10:30 on the Thursday morning as the first presentation.
Yeah.
But we thought rather than everybody having to get up half an hour earlier than they absolutely have to, we would do that little bit ahead of the event. We would record it, we would make it available via the CMU channels and the Great Escape channels. And so, yes, we had that extra little presentation and we pushed it out through the podcast feed. So if you were really confused about what that was, that's what that was. And now you know.
Yes. So this is actually, this is the first proper podcast for 2 weeks, if you don't count that little seminar.
Which I don't.
Which we don't. So we've got 2 weeks worth of news to look through. Unfortunately, the last 2 weeks has been, in fact, the last few days, as we recall, this has not been great for news.
No. So, some obviously big and terrible news occurred earlier this week, which is just a big, terrible story anyway, and obviously had a music dimension to it. So we are talking about the terrorist attack on the Manchester Arena on Monday night, which we're not really going to talk about on the podcast because we don't really think it's appropriate for this sort of format. But a big story across the board with a big music business element to it. And obviously we have been covering it in the CMU Daily.
We should also acknowledge the sad and tragic death of Chris Cornell, Soundgarden, Audioslave, who died aged just 52 while we were off. Yeah, as I say, it wasn't the most fun couple of weeks for news.
Yeah, so some very bad stories over the last couple of weeks, which, as I say, we're not going to talk about on the podcast other than acknowledging them here, which we felt we ought to. But as we say, we don't really feel this is the appropriate format for either of those stories. We are reporting on them in the CMU Daily. And instead, we're going to delve and have a look at some of the other music business events that have happened in the last fortnight.
Yes, so coming up this week, we've got the rescinding of Universal's $30 million deal with the Prince Estate, Festival Republic's plans to introduce drugs testing to some of its festivals. But first, let's have a look at, we've got a general election coming up in the UK, as UK listeners will know, and people outside the UK may not know.
Or care.
Having been outside the UK for a general election once, I suddenly came over quite angry when the results were announced in the middle of the day, and someone asked why, and they had no idea there was anything going on in the UK. So that was quite soothing at the time.
Yes.
Like, oh, it doesn't actually matter at all.
No. So we are having this general election, of course, called out of the blue, sort of a post-European referendum election, a year on from the referendum. Brexit is now underway.
Yes, we launched into the negotiating period for the UK leaving the European Union. And then Theresa May thought the best way to spend the first 2 months of that would be campaigning for a general election in the UK so as to take 2 months off the already impossible length of time we have to negotiate.
Yes. So because of the rules, we have a 2-year window. I mean, I suspect in the end it will end up being a lot longer than that. But that is reliant on the other 27 members of the EU agreeing to that.
Which may take 2 years at a time.
So 2 years.
We'll probably start negotiating that now. That's the first thing we should negotiate, an extension.
An extension on the time. So in theory, we've got 2 years to negotiate. And yes, we've wasted the first 2 months of that on a very tedious general election coming up on the 8th of June. I have to say that up until last week, I was very much in the Great Escape mentality because we sort of went into production and we were doing all the admin and marketing and pulling it all together. So there is about a month where my brain is basically by default on Great Escape. That is what I am focusing on. And so therefore, I found it very confusing during that period that my social media feeds were full of the hashtag GE2017, which GE to me, Great Escape.
Yep.
Why are all these people tweeting about the Great Escape? That has nothing to do with the Great Escape. How is that anything? Oh, no. General election. 2017, because obviously that the hashtag for The Great Escape actually is TGE. But now The Great Escape is over, my brain is able to readjust, focus on the election that is coming up. So now GE 2017 does mean the general election. And you've brought this up for a couple of reasons, but one reason is that the various manifestos are out there.
Yes.
Including, obviously, the two main parties, unless something really radical and surprising happens, certainly outside of Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, we are looking at predominantly Conservative versus Labour battle.
Yes.
They have both put out their manifestos. I assume you've read them both from cover to cover.
Of course.
What's your favourite bit?
Well, my favourite bits are the music-related ones, or creative industries-related bits of both manifestos.
Well, that's very selfish and inward-looking,
isn't it?
To ignore all of the stuff on health and the economy and our future in Europe, all that stuff in the Conservative Party conference about turning off the internet.
I'm adopting a position for the relevance of our listeners.
You're trying to justify why, on our Music Business podcast, we've put the general election in the United Kingdom as the first story.
Yes.
What could this mean for music, is what
you're
saying.
Yes, that is what I'm saying. What could it mean for music?
So what could it mean for music?
Well, it could mean a number of things. I guess, first off, whoever wins the election, Theresa May and the Conservatives, will be negotiating Brexit. And so all the music industry trade bodies, particularly the BPI and UK Music, have spent a lot of time recently putting out statements saying, really need to make sure that music is looked after in the Brexit negotiations. I mean, and given that it's going to be largely disastrous for every industry, I'm not sure why the music industry should get any preferential treatment. But both manifestos, Labour and Conservative, do have sections for the creative industries that look at Brexit and more widely. In the Labour manifesto, there's a big section on introducing agent of change, so that protecting live venues in the UK, which is obviously something that has been campaigned for very strongly, particularly by the Music Venues Trust.
And discussed here on the CMU podcast.
Discussed right here.
So actually there in the Labour manifesto. But I suppose specifically with Brexit, is there any indications there? I mean, this is something we actually discussed at The Great Escape, of course.
Yes.
As part of our export conference. And we had the BPI there. So we had Ian from the BPI. We also had the Musicians Union, the Featured Artists Coalition, and various other people bringing their sort of perspectives, whether it be a live perspective, a legal perspective, physical product perspective, of the potential impact that Brexit could have on the music industry, depending on quite how we exit the European Union.
Yeah, and I think the conclusion of that panel was largely that the music industry will get through it and be okay, but it would be a lot better if it didn't happen at all.
But assuming that's not an option.
That's not an option. Well, there are things that will happen. There are things that are already happening. So one thing, when Naomi from the MU is saying that the UK has already lost two orchestras to Europe who've decided that we're leaving and there's not really a future for them in the UK.
And that's, I suppose, because although we don't really know what's going to happen, what the deal will look like, just the unpredictability, not knowing how easy it will be to tour, how easy it will be to hire people from across the EU. They've already made the decision. In much the same way as we're seeing in other sectors, particularly the financial sector, people are already saying, OK, we're going to assume the worst and we're going to start making contingency plans elsewhere right now.
Yes, because there are things like the movement of people and the movement of goods around Europe. A lot of vinyl and CDs that's pressed for the UK market are actually pressed in Europe.
Particularly Eastern Europe.
And so transporting them across Europe, if there are tariffs in place, particularly if we come out of the EU without a deal, which is looking quite likely, that's going to be problematic. That's going to raise costs. And plus, just touring. If you have to have a visa for every European country when you tour outside the UK, that's going to introduce a massive new cost for UK artists. And it might probably be okay for your bigger artist, your Ed Sheeran, and it's going to be annoying for him. It's not going to be too big a problem. But a little artist who are on a tight budget already, that is going to cause a significant problem for them. And it may really damage the lower end of the touring market from the UK.
Yeah, if there's new bureaucracy and or fees that go with it. And even with the bigger artists, although they will continue to tour and they'll just swallow that extra admin cost, if those costs also apply to every single member of their crew, then you might say, well, rather than taking a big British crew with us around Europe, where we have to fill out all those forms and pay any fees, let's just hire a European crew. Let's hire a crew within the EU and have them tour around with the artists in Europe. So even though it won't affect the bigger artists, it might affect the session musicians, all the people who work with them.
Yes, correct. And I mean, none of the manifestos say anything about any of that, but those are some of the many, many issues raised by the music industry about the future in Europe. This is going on in every industry, so it's just, you can't put this in a manifesto because the manifesto would be it would take the entire 2 years to write.
But I suppose there is, whether it's looking at the manifestos or it's asking questions of potential members of parliament from the two parties, I suppose it's what questions should you ask them? So we've already written out, as far as the music industry is concerned, those are some of our concerns. So touring, probably top of the list. Physical product, particularly sort of CD and merchandise. There's a bit of copyright law to throw in there too. Employing musicians and executives. Those are sort of the lists of priorities. And yes, UK Music and the Musicians Union and the BPI, they will all be lobbying hard on those issues once the Brexit negotiations are underway. But I suppose it's an element of asking the MPs and the representatives of the two parties, well, what will your priorities be once these Brexit negotiations are underway? And will our list, bearing in mind every single industry is going to be piling a list of priorities on the table, is there any chance of our priorities actually being taken into consideration? So the manifestos aren't going to really talk about that, but that's a question, I guess, to be asking, given that in the run-up to general election, all the politicians are desperate to have conversations with you and appear to be helpful, that is a good time to be asking those questions in the 2 weeks that remain.
Yeah, and now I think both manifestos address the value gap, which is obviously the music industry's big bugbear. And obviously at an EU level, there's already stuff going ahead to potentially, although as we've discussed, possibly not, reduce the use of safe harbours by companies like YouTube.
The proviso you put there is it is in the European Copyright Directive, which, okay, that's still only a draft, but the final version of that directive will almost certainly have that article dealing with the use of the safe harbour by services like YouTube, which creates this so-called value gap. However, how useful that article will be actually in court, we have debated at length on the podcast. But I suppose it's interesting, with the copyright directive that's going through, there's almost a race going on. This is something we also talked about at the Great Escape, albeit within our royalties conference, that there's sort of a race at the moment because the copyright directive, there's some ridiculous number of amendments that have been put forward in Brussels. That's all going to go through the motion. How long will it take for the directive to get passed by both the European Parliament and the EU Council? Then, as it's currently written, there will be a one-year deadline from that point for each member state to implement the new rules within the copyright directive. Versus Brexit, which, as we've discussed, is now on a just under two-year deadline unless that gets extended. So it could be that the directive gets implemented before Brexit or just after Brexit, depending on how those two timelines work out.
Yes.
However, I suppose what both the manifestos are suggesting, and indeed the Intellectual Property Office here in the UK has suggested this, is even if it turns out that Brexit happens on Monday and the directive goes into force on Friday, actually the UK government is very likely to implement pretty much all of this directive anyway, voluntarily, even though it may not be obliged to, and that would include that safe harbour article. So there is some support from both parties to make that happen, although with the same proviso that at a UK level, it may end up being useless for the music industry.
Theresa May's government have indicated that they don't plan to radically overhaul UK copyright law once the UK is outside the European Union. They'll pretty much still mirror what's there, which kind of makes sense. That, you know, we're still going to be part of Europe, even if we're not part of the European Union. And obviously, we'll be tied very much to Europe in terms of trade. So it kind of makes sense to stick to what's already there and possibly implement things, like new things that are coming in from Europe. However, who knows what will happen? Because, you know, once the UK is out on its own, the tech lobby is very strong. They might all gang up on the UK and make things bad for the music industry. So I think that's another reason why the music industry is shouting particularly loud at the moment.
Another thing to consider, I suppose, is the Conservative Manifesto, not that I've read it from cover to cover in any way, shape or form, but it has a big section on internet regulation in general.
Yes.
And I think from a PR perspective here, in terms of the music industry and the copyright industries, and sometimes when they're trying to enforce their rights, particularly online, it then comes across really badly, which can sort of backfire because it makes the average web user go, oh, screw the music industry. I'm going to carry on downloading music because I see you as being some horrible corporate that's abusing their rights or whatever. And I can see that the Conservatives have got a whole bunch of stuff they're going to do with the internet, some of which is perfectly decent stuff, trying to crack down on extremist content, trying to put some controls on particularly, you know, on pornographic content and who gets to access that stuff. So there is some good stuff in there, but then it sort of is framed in the way that politicians talk. We're going to stop all of this on the internet and we're going to control the internet.
Yeah.
And it just sort of from a technology point of view, you look at it and it's like, yeah, this reads like somebody who doesn't really understand how the internet works. have you heard of a VPN? Oh, we're going to outlaw VPNs. Oh, good luck with that. So, I feel if it ends up that all of that becomes a big part of the next government's sort of mission, and then any sort of reform of copyright in the internet space, like safe harbors, gets bundled into that, oh, we're going to reinvent the internet, then even if the music industry, the copyright industries have a point in trying to get some reforms, it might then get tarnished with this whole PR of a bunch of old people who don't understand the internet trying to reinvent the web.
Which it already has done.
So again, there's a sort of a legal element to this. And as always, when you're trying to introduce new rules to regulate the distributed content online and copyright online, there's also a PR element of does it mean that the copyright industries will just be hated again by the world at large?
So that's what the industry is saying. But what about artists? I mean, I would say artists are more involved in politics right now at this moment than we've noticed in recent years.
So this is another thing we talked about at The Great Escape.
I'd say we don't hold to the argument that political music doesn't exist anymore. We've never held to that argument. However, music is becoming a lot more political.
And musicians are becoming
more political.
As
we get closer to this general election. I think that's partly down to, you don't vote for the Prime Minister, you vote for your local politician. But the two figureheads of the two parties are so different from each other now. It's polarised people's views. I mean, musicians typically seem to be coming out in favour of Jeremy Corbyn, particularly in the grime industry, where a lot of artists are coming out and saying, like, I've never voted before and I'm behind this guy. I mean, JME has been particularly vocal in saying that. I've never seen any difference in the parties before or any point in voting, but now I see, like, there's something worth voting for.
And this we discussed as part of John Robb's Pop Question Time, which we brought back for The Great Escape this year, and you sat on that.
I did.
Alongside a couple of musicians and Serena Kaczynski, who's a journalist who writes about both music and politics. And yeah, we talked about musicians becoming more political, and not necessarily in their music. Artists becoming political doesn't necessarily mean that they're writing protest songs. It may be that the music itself is political, or the video around the songs is political, or it may simply be the alliances they make, the organisations they support, what they say in the public space. And I suppose also there is a distinction to be made between those artists who are overtly supporting one side over the other, and perhaps unsurprisingly, the more vocal artists in that regard are supporting Labour and Corbyn, or those artists who are simply going out and saying, particularly if they've got a younger fan base, I'm not telling you who to vote for, please register to vote and vote. And we've seen a lot of that as well. And I think in the grime community, some people overtly saying, we're backing Corbyn, others saying, we're not telling you who to vote for, but hey, we think our fan base are the sorts of people who've never voted before and we're encouraging them to take an interest this time.
Yeah, because I suppose a thing that came out of the EU referendum vote was, whether this is true or not, it seemed like it was people in their 60s voting for the future of 16 to 25-year-olds.
Who didn't vote.
Yes. So the young people did not vote for their future. The old people, whose opinions are quite conservative, did. And so, there was a fear that that was going to happen with this election. And so there has been a real kind of rallying of young people. And obviously, musicians come into that because that's their main market. Not that I'm saying they're doing it for business reasons, as that just sounded like.
Although they might be.
Well, they might be.
Who knows? But it'll be interesting to see whether artists continue to be vocal in the run-up to the general election. Also, does it swing the vote? And I suppose it may be that, obviously, these are slightly sweeping statements, but I think it is true that the older demographic, a higher proportion tend to vote to the right, with the younger demographic, a higher proportion vote to the left. That's not to say there are right-wing young people and left-wing old people, so I'm not making that as a total sweeping statement, but I think that most of the research suggests that that is true. And I suppose, yes, if those artists, particularly the grime artists, can persuade a much higher number of young people to vote for the first time, then that could swing things slightly to Labour's advantage. I mean, I think we all still assume that we will still have the same Prime Minister and the same core government on June the 9th, but we will see, I guess. I think there's also that question, which is an interesting discussion, which you partly touched on with the Pop Question Time panel, which is musicians, not universally, but I think in the main, more musicians lean to the left than lean to the right. And I think the musicians who are vocal tend to be the left-leaning. This may be slightly less true with some genres in the US, but I think in the main, right-leaning artists often keep the politics out of the public domain, whereas left-leaning artists are much more upfront about that.
Yeah.
So we sort of live in a world where sort of musicians and creative people who can be increasingly vocal on politics because they now have their social media channels so they can get that out there, they lean to the left. Yet certainly in the UK and the US, politics has been swinging to the right in recent years.
Yeah.
And so therefore it's like, well, do all these musicians have any effect anyway, given that the causes they seem to be championing are the causes that the public at large are not? And it almost, can it backfire that the people are like, oh, for God's sake, shut up, celebrities. I'm sick to death of you telling me what to do. In fact, I'm going to vote opposite for what you're saying just because I'm bored of hearing you spouting your opinions.
Well, I guess we'll see. But it does seem that it certainly enthusing young people to vote or to register to vote has had an effect.
And that could swing things slightly
to
the left.
That could swing things a bit more in Labour's favour. But, yeah, we'll see. I mean, if from the starting point of this general election was like, ugh, what's even the point? The Tories were so far ahead in the polls, it seemed like it was just a kind of, you know, a pointless election to make a point and keep the Conservatives in power for an extra 2 years.
With it. Probably an increased majority.
But now it's become more exciting, hasn't it? It still looks likely that Theresa May is going to win, but it's less of a clear-cut call.
So we will see overnight, June the 8th, June the 9th. For those of you who do not live in the United Kingdom, we apologise for boring you with our parochial insular politics, but that's life in 2017, isn't it? We're all increasingly insular. Screw the world. It's all about us. So we thought we'd reflect that with the first section of our podcast.
Still to come on this week's podcast, we've got our news in brief, plus moves to allow people to test the safety of their drugs before they take them at festivals. But now, a little Prince legal news roundup, because there's been quite a bit of it in the 2 weeks we've been off.
We talked about that, I think, on the last podcast, or maybe the one before, about how the Prince litigation is now starting to pile up.
Yeah.
A year on from his untimely death. In fact, we sort of got a thing going in the office, haven't we, where we've got the Fyre Festival litigation over here and the Prince litigation over here, and we're seeing which one's going to be highest.
I think the Fyre Festival is winning.
By the end of the summer, but some decent Prince litigation to come. A couple of things to quickly mention, and then we'll talk about the main one.
Yeah, just a couple of quick ones. So the injunction to block the release of that unreleased Prince EP has been extended indefinitely, which we presume means that the Prince estate paid up the $1 million that the court was asking for in exchange for that.
Yes, so that was just putting money on the table. They'll get it back, but I think it is a bond, if you like, as the litigation continues. So just to recap on that, that was this producer guy, a sound engineer who worked with Prince back in about 2004, 2005, worked on a few tracks and then put them out as a six-track EP to coincide with the first anniversary of Prince's death.
Or was about to put them out. He'd put out one song.
And yes, he announced his six-track EP was coming. And then the Prince estate said, whoa, that's totally in violation of a contract that you had with Prince at the time. We subsequently know now that that was a confidentiality agreement, which is a bit weird, but a confidentiality agreement that then had a copyright line in it, I assume. And so they said, you're in breach of contract, but that is then all to be tested in court, whether or not they are in breach of contract. So they sought, in essence, an injunction to stop the distribution of these tracks while all this litigation is going through the motions. They initially got an order that basically said, OK, you can't release these tracks, Mr. Producer, for a fortnight. Just a fortnight. The fortnight passed. Then they got extended for another fortnight. That's where the commitment came on the Prince estate side to put this $1 million on the table, on the producer side to hand over the masters of all the recordings that he had from his time working with Prince to the estate.
Yes.
And then that was another fortnight. That fortnight expired earlier this week. And now, basically, we've got a proper preliminary injunction in place that basically says, OK, none of these tracks are going to get distributed until this contractual dispute has been settled. So we don't have to keep going back to court every 2 weeks to get the order extended. We have a proper injunction in place, and we'll wait to see how long it takes for the proper contractual dispute to actually get to court.
That's, I mean, you might think that, you know, the lawyers having to go to court to do this every 2 weeks would be a bit tedious, but they'll probably be in the court anyway. Well, they do seem to be back and forth fairly regularly. Not least, well, in fact, they're probably less so now because there was obviously the ongoing proceedings to work out who Prince's heirs are. And in the last 2 weeks, the presumed heirs
are now not presumed.
All six of them are no longer presumed. They are heirs.
So obviously Prince did not leave a will. Hey, pop stars, with your multi-million dollar estates, please write a will. Actually, from our perspective, don't.
It's much better for us if you don't.
Journalistically, it's much better when you don't, but legally you should. And so a whole load of people came forward claiming to be heirs to Prince. It's the six siblings, so some siblings, some half-siblings, who are now have been officially recognised as heirs to the estate. There were an assortment of other more distant relatives or alleged relatives who also came forward. They were all crossed off the list until these six siblings were left. Although, as I understand it, those six siblings now having been confirmed as heirs, there is now another year that other people can come forward. So we could as yet see some other people coming forward, although you have to think anyone who felt that they had a claim to the Prince estate would have come forward by now. So probably...
I was going to be sitting there in 6 months ago, do you know what, actually?
I remember Prince.
I used to live with Prince as a child, maybe.
Prince was my father or whatever. So, yeah, those six heirs. Now, as we've discussed before on the podcast, those heirs are sort of split into two. They form two groups. They have different representation and they seem to disagree on quite a lot of stuff. So although we now have six heirs confirmed, that doesn't mean that we necessarily have agreement amongst those heirs, because they disagree quite a bit on who should be running the estate and what deals should be done and who they're being advised by. So there will remain some tensions amongst those heirs, but at least they have all been confirmed as being beneficiaries of this multi-million dollar estate. Although, not as much money to benefit from as perhaps we thought a couple of months ago.
No, because I think as we've talked before, this story has been rumbling on for a few weeks now. Earlier this year, Universal did a number of deals with the Prince estate for various aspects of its business, one of which was for recordings, which gave, at the time, it gave Universal access to kind of the latter half of Prince's recordings catalogue and the vault of unreleased recordings. And then a weird sort of thing that said, you'll get access to his earlier albums when they come out of contract with Warner.
So this was the deal specifically around Prince's recordings. So separate to the deal around his publishing catalogue, separate to the merchandise deals. They were three separate deals, although Universal won the bidding on all. The recordings deal alone was worth in excess of $30 million.
Yep.
And as you say, it was a little bit confusing from the start. It didn't help that the deal was announced just as the Prince catalogue went back onto Spotify and the other streaming services following that sort of exclusivity period with Tidal. So we were sort of getting two announcements at once, weren't we? We got one announcement from Universal saying Universal have got the rights to represent the Prince recordings catalogue. So that's all the albums that Prince in essence self-released.
Yeah.
Once he fell out with Warner, he set up his own record company. So most of those latter albums he put out himself or on a license with another record company. So they represent all of that. The vault of unreleased stuff. And then they have access to some of the albums from the 80s, the early 90s, where I suppose most of the big hits sit.
Yeah.
And so they had some access to that. And then we immediately get a press release from Warner Music saying, oh, we represent all of this and we're putting it back on the streaming services. So immediately that was confusing. And then once we started to dig, well, it is confusing, hence why this deal is now falling apart. Before he died, you may remember, a couple of years ago, or I think it was 2014, wasn't it? That's 3 years ago now. Prince announced a big new deal with Warner Music. So Warner was his original record company in the 80s and the early 90s. They put out the big hit albums, the big hit tracks. He spectacularly fell out with Warner. That's famous. Prince is falling out with Warner Music in the early 90s. And then they stopped talking to each other. And Prince went off and released a ridiculous number of albums himself through his own record company. And then he made up with Warner Music. And the terms of that deal at the time weren't entirely clear. But basically, as we understood it, when Prince started working again with Warner Music, through that deal, he basically got back the American rights in his recording catalogue. And this partly relates to the termination right or the reversion right that we've talked about before on the podcast, which is where American copyright law says that if you assign your copyrights to a corporate entity so that they become the copyright owner, after 35 years, you have the statutory right to terminate that contract and take the rights back. Now, in the main, the reversion termination right has been used when it comes to song copyrights on publishing deals. It remains a debate as to whether or not it even applies to record deals for tedious copyright reasons we won't go into and how you define a record contract and all sorts of stuff. But as we understood it, Warner Music didn't want a big test case with Prince, the result of which could be a precedent that says, OK, the reversion right does apply to recordings. So Prince's lawyers were able to use that as a negotiating tactic. The reversion right only applies within the US. So under that 2014 deal, Prince got back the copyright in his 80s and 90s recordings in the US. Warner retained the rights outside the US, where the reversion right wouldn't apply anyway. Prince then licensed back his American catalogue to Warner, agreed to participate in a big re-release campaign and a remastering campaign, a reissue campaign, and everybody was happy, everyone was making some money, and so it moved forward. Which meant that when the Prince estate sat down with Universal, post-Warner catalogue, easy, the vaults, possibly easy, although any recordings in the vaults that were recorded while Prince was under contract to Warner, Warner may have a veto on whether or not those can be released. So there's even some complications with the vaults. But the 80s and 90s catalogue, it was basically the deal was when we, the estate, get the rights back to these hits, which in the main is when the licensing deal in the US expires, because they, in essence, they've already taken those rights back under the 2014 deal, but then they licensed them to Warner. But there were some confusions that different things would revert at different points in different territories, and sometimes it was different for the digital versus the vinyl versus the CD. That 2014 was very complicated.
Yeah.
And what rights Universal had in the 80s, 90s catalogue very much depended on when those rights reverted to the estate under that Warner contract. It transpires, perhaps unsurprisingly, that it was the big 80s and 90s hits that Universal were really interested in. Well, a big portion of that 30 million, the value of that was for the hits. And basically it transpires that Universal, having done that deal, handed over the 30 million, have now basically gone through the paperwork, and it turns out that they won't get those hits as soon as they thought they were going to get them, or at all. And the allegation that has been made from Universal Music's part is that L. Londell McMillan, who was the lawyer who was advising the estate at the time,
who is no longer, as we think we've discussed on here before,
but is continuing to advise some of the heirs, extra complication, but he's no longer working for the estate, but he was leading on that at the time. The allegation is that he misled Universal on quite what they were getting access to, or that they were going to get access to the hit sooner than that Warner contract from 2014 allows. He has denied that, but that is the allegation. And so basically Universal are now coming and saying, we did this deal because of bad information, misrepresentation, to use the legal term. So we want out of this deal and we want our 30 million back. So there were rumours of this, and then there was a bit of paperwork, which actually was nothing to do with this, but which confirmed that this dispute was brewing, that was filed with court. And now we're actually getting paperwork filed with the court by the estate directly relating to this dispute.
Yes. So the most recent filing on this Commercia, which is now the bank that's overseeing the estate, took over from the Bremer Trust.
Yeah, they're doing all the administration, but they only came on board after these Universal deals were done.
They've now recommended that this deal be rescinded. We've got a court date of the 31st of May. So by the end of next week, we may know if Universal's getting it 30 million back. At which point, presumably, the recordings will be put out for tender again.
Yes. So both...
Which may mean that Universal gets them again.
Well, Universal could rebid at a lower rate because they could say, now we know exactly what we're getting. We think it's worth 20 million or whatever. Also, Sony could re-enter that field. Warner could re-enter the field. I mean, there is an argument that why not just stick it all with Warner?
It would seem to make more sense to just give it to Warner.
I mean, you have to assume Universal were offering the most money, which is why they went with Universal, unless they thought it made sense to have recordings, publishing and merch all in one house, although I'm not sure it really does, because it's not like Universal Publishing and Universal Recordings, although they're the same company, they sort of operate autonomously anyway.
I mean, it may now mean that now that the complexities of the deal have been revealed, that may put off everyone other than Warner.
Yes,
because Warner's the only one who can go, well, that doesn't matter.
Hopefully Warner understand the specifics of the 2014 deal that they did with Prince. Whether or not there's anyone outside the majors who could bid, I'm not sure there is, in terms of A, being able to afford to put that advance on the table, and B, having the expertise and the infrastructure to do something with those recordings. I think a non-music company might have the money, but they'd immediately have to outsource all the work, probably to a major anyway. So we probably are talking Universal rebidding at a lower rate, or Sony or Warner. But whatever, it seems almost certain that this 30 million advance will go down. We don't know how much, but we have to assume that the heirs might be a bit annoyed about that. Some of the heirs are being represented by McMillan, so they will presumably say, oh, this is all Universal's fault, whatever. But those heirs who are not being advised by McMillan, who've already been critical of his work on the estate, well, whatever happens with this deal, there could be a whole messy stuff going on in terms of what happened with the original agreement.
This isn't L. Londell Macmillan's first accusation of mishandling things to do with the Prince estate, because the heirs who are no longer representative by him have previously accused him of that.
There was a tribute concert, wasn't there, that didn't deliver the goods like some of the heirs were hoping. So I'd say we should stress again that he has disputed all of these allegations about his conduct. He had worked with Prince for many years, and he has insisted that he did everything for the benefit of the estate. So I assume that the handling of that original deal may well then get discussed in court, either as part of this attempt to rescind the agreement, or if there's any subsequent legal wrangling between the heirs as to how that original deal was done. But yeah, we should know in a couple of weeks' time whether or not Universal are going to try and keep representing Prince Recordings, but with a smaller financial commitment, or whether they are up for tender and we can all get our bids in again.
Just time now for some news in brief. Let's start off with John Webster, Webbo, who is leaving the MMF as its president, having stepped down as its CEO last year.
Yes, so Webbo ran the Music Managers Forum for a number of years, and on his watch, I think it's fair to say that the MMF grew, certainly in terms of membership and in terms of profile and the activity it did, became a much more vocal representative of the management community and the artists that those managers work for. Yes, he stepped down as CEO at the start of last year, but stayed on as president to continue to advise and was involved in various projects, but has now decided to step back completely, partly because, and he's been promising this ever since he stood down as CEO, he's been promising he's writing his memoirs from his time at Virgin Records in the 80s, when Virgin was still owned by Branson, and he had various roles at Virgin, but ultimately he was MD of the record company. So he's been promising this memoir for a while now, so hopefully now he's stepping down from his president role, he can focus on that full time, because I'm looking forward to reading
I think that will be a book worth reading. Also on the MMF and The Great Escape, because they launched this at The Great Escape, they've just published a mental health guide for artist managers, both in terms of artist managers looking after their own mental health and the mental health of their artists.
So this continues the conversation which we began at the 2016 Great Escape, when we put the focus on mental health in the music community. And obviously there's been lots of research and discussions around mental health in the music industry since then. And I think most discussions on the mental health, particularly of artists, always comes down to the fact, well, the manager is the one person who has a 24/7 connection with their artist. So a certain amount of responsibility falls down on management. Do management have the necessary skills? And so this is a sort of a guide offering some sort of top level advice to managers on both how they can better care for the welfare of their artists, but also for themselves and their teams, because that's as important as ensuring the health of the people who actually make the music.
A story we've been discussing on the podcast for some time now has reached something of a conclusion, in that Guvera has now ceased operations.
It has finally shut down.
So it took longer than anyone thought, but Guvera is gone.
So the digital music platform that has been around for years, because it was originally an advertising-funded download platform in that brief period in history where people thought that was a good idea, then became...
Guvera was not the only company to think that was a good idea.
It was not. Then became a streaming service, had both an ad-funded element and a subscription element, although really pushed the ad-funded and was saying, oh, we're going to go into markets like India, where advertising makes much more sense. Bumped along for a few years, never seemed to be getting the growth. Well, had decent user numbers, but not in terms of revenue. Had that catastrophic attempt at IPO last summer,
which is kind of, that was the beginning of the end.
Very much the beginning of the end, where they basically admitted just how much money they were losing. It was such a bad IPO prospectus that the stock exchange on which they wished to float did the almost unprecedented thing of banning them from floating, which then basically destroyed the company. They bailed on various markets. They put some subsidiaries into administration. They attempted to continue, particularly in those emerging markets, but it seemed likely they weren't going to last the distance. And then, yes, one Friday night in the last couple of weeks, they put out a statement to their investors saying that the one co-founder who had stayed with the business had now resigned completely. There was basically one person left on the board. And yes, all operations have ceased. And so it remains to be seen what the final stage of that, because there's still people owed money. There's still people owed money from their brief attempt to launch in the UK by acquiring Tesco's Blinkbox. That all went legal. There are two lawsuits relating to that still outstanding. So it remains to be seen quite what happens with that. They were saying they still have some IP they can potentially exploit to try and pay off those debts, but who knows? But anyway, officially, Guevara is no longer operating.
And a nice bit of litigation to finish this section on. PayPal is suing Pandora, saying that the new logo that Pandora launched in October of last year not only looks a lot like PayPal's logo, but is causing problems for its customers, because on the smartphone apps, customers keep opening the Pandora app by mistake when they mean to open the PayPal app.
So Pandora rebranded last year, and their new branding is a lot better than their old branding. Their old branding was a bit rubbish, but it's the P that is causing problems here, because obviously Pandora's logo says Pandora. PayPal's logo says PayPal. That's not a problem. The problem is when you just hone in on the P, which the icon on the app does, and they're saying that Pandora's new P is too like PayPal's P, and that is confusing people.
They are quite similar. A part of PayPal's legal papers to launch this case was included. I mean, it was a very detailed lawsuit that went into great detail on why Pandora should be stopped and should pay damages to PayPal. But part of the paperwork had a page of 20 tweets from people saying things like, "I just went to open PayPal and Bare Naked Ladies started playing. That's a bit weird." So they presumably think that that. Really, that's an example of the public saying this is confusing.
And that said, for that to happen, that person has to have installed both a PayPal app and a Pandora app on their phone. So presumably they weren't confused for too long when Bare Naked Ladies started playing, because they are clearly customers of both services.
Well, clearly, I mean...
Because neither of those apps can be on your phone without you installing them.
Well, correct.
So here I am building Pandora's defence for free. What am I doing? I'm going to stop talking. They need to start paying me. PayPal did say they tried to persuade Pandora. I don't know what they'd said to Pandora. Become Andorra. Don't use the better. Quite know what.
Well, change it. It's not they don't mind Pandora's logo being a P. It's just that it's kind of, it looks really like PayPal's P.
So they tried to persuade Pandora to voluntarily change their logo, seemingly with no positive conclusion, hence them going legal.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens with that. You can read all of those stories at completemusicupdate.com/podcast. Well, you'll find the show notes for this show and links to all of those stories within it. Finally this week, talk about another thing that relates to The Great Escape.
Last mention of The Great Escape.
Not that we're plugging our own stuff.
But so we had the drugs conference.
This is not something that's come off the back of The Great Escape at all. This is Melvin Benn of Festival Republic gave an interview to the Press Association, I think, in which he said that Festival Republic are aiming to launch drug testing at a number of their festivals. He wasn't sure how many yet or which festivals. Between 6 and 10 festivals, he reckoned, probably Leeds Festival. And this would see them partnering with an organisation called The Loop.
A brilliant organisation.
A brilliant organisation called The Loop.
Look them up.
Who launched at Secret Garden Party last year. And basically what they do is they let you come along, you give them a bit of the drugs you've got, they test them, and then they tell you what is actually in what you've given them, and then you can make an informed decision about whether or not you want to put rat poison up your nose.
Yes.
And then The Loop destroy the bit of the rat poison or maybe drugs that you've given them.
So this is an initiative that has already happened at some festivals in continental Europe, depending on the local drug laws. Also in Amsterdam, not at venues and events, but there are centres in Amsterdam on the high street where you can take drugs you've bought. Obviously, when you're buying drugs, you're buying them almost by definition illegally from a supplier who you may or may not trust. So it's a place where you can go in, they chemically test what you have, and as you say, tell you whether or not it is safe to consume, maybe also what strength it is that you've bought, because none of this will be told to you. So this does happen elsewhere in continental Europe. We're starting to see it happening in some clubs over here in the UK, and as you say, piloted at the Secret Garden Party Festival last year. There is talk that actually somewhere in London, I think in Tower Hamlets, they might be opening a drop-in centre like the ones we have in Amsterdam. So the whole idea about this is, well, obviously this is tricky, because in theory, you're not meant to have these drugs.
Yes.
And so by having these centres, whether it's on the high street, whether it's at a club, whether it's at a festival, it requires us to admit people are going to have drugs that the law has decided you shouldn't have. What should we do with those people? Should we arrest them because they have these drugs? Or should we tell them what drugs they've had so we can save their lives? And I think certainly the conversation at the Great Escape as part of our drugs conference was very much the latter is definitely the way to go. Schemes like this are brilliant and we should definitely be encouraging them. But I suppose, you know, looking at it from a venue owner or a festival promoter's point of view, as a venue owner, as a promoter, you need to have a good working relationship with local law enforcement, local police force. And that was one thing that Melvin Ben was saying, wasn't he? They've been considering this for a while, but it was important to them that they just didn't do it off their own back, that they were consulting with the police forces that they work with to ensure there was a bit of buy-in on that side.
Yes, because, I mean, this isn't the first time that people have tried to get this sort of scheme off the ground. But, like you say, the problem is these drugs are illegal and you have police on your festival site and at your club, whatever, to do certain bits of law enforcement, one of which is arresting people who've got illegal drugs.
Or at the very least, confiscating the drugs.
Or confiscating the drugs. But what the aim of this is obviously to look after people's safety and acknowledge that it's ridiculous to think that you can just flat out stop people taking drugs. And if you confiscate one person's drugs, other people aren't going to be taking them. And if they don't know what's in those drugs, they're taking those drugs at a risk to themselves that is avoidable.
And even if, and I mean, this is one of the conversations that we had at the drugs conference and around sort of the whole fabric debacle last year, there is that thing of even if you could stop people taking drugs into your club or into your festival, which actually you can't because sniffer dogs are not anywhere near as effective as people think. So unless you're literally going to strip search everybody,
which is not practical
at all in any way, shape or form. Assuming you're not going to do that, a certain amount, I would probably suspect a significant amount of the drugs that people are trying to carry in will go on site. But even if you could stop people from carrying drugs in with them, you can't stop them swallowing the drugs before they enter your site.
Yes.
And actually, there's various research to suggest that when you have full-on, really tough sort of searches going on and sniffer dogs on the entrance, people are more likely to then basically take whatever they have in their pocket, and then you are definitely putting them at risk because they will probably be consuming a way bigger dosage than they otherwise would and definitely more than they should in one go. So rather than doing all of that, let's say, no, this is about saving lives, and so let's help people, let's educate people, and as part of that, let's educate them into, I mean, so it's first of all knowing that just because somebody tells you they're selling you one substance, that does not mean that that is what you are getting. And so here is a bit of guidance that says that this is what you have bought, and here is the best advice that we can give you. We showed at the Great Escape Drugs Conference, Vice are putting out a number of videos over the summer as part of a harm reduction program, which basically tells you the safest way to consume different drugs, which again is tricky messaging.
Yeah.
Because they're sort of basically accepting that the people watching these videos are going to take these drugs. Actually, they start off by saying, well, we discussed this at the Great Escape, that if you start off by saying you shouldn't take these drugs, but if you do, here's some educational advice, then people will stop listening with that first sentence. And everything you say afterwards, they won't hear. So they've cleverly done it in the videos where they sort of basically say, obviously, the safest thing to do with this drug is not take it.
Well, actually,
But they're not saying don't take it. And then they're saying, you know, this is how you should take it. This is what you need to be careful of. This is how you consume this safely.
The film we screened at The Great Escape, actually, the opening of it was very cleverly done. So it was presented by Jammer, Grime MC from Boy Better Know. And he kind of started by saying, weed has been around me my whole life. My parents smoke weed. It's been very much part of the community I grew up in. But then 15 years ago, skunk came in and there was something different about that. And I'm interested in what the difference and how, you know, what harm it could be doing versus what my parents smoke. And that was sort of the starting point. And it went on and he talked to scientists about the chemical makeup of it and how that's different to other strains of marijuana. And he spoke to people who use it, who've been affected negatively by it, people who have stopped using it and what they've done to kind of help themselves out of it. And then Jammer's own personal perspectives on it. It's like a 15-minute, really interesting, well-made film that, yeah, I think does get the messaging right.
And you can go and see that. That was published the week before The Great Escape as part of Mental Health Awareness Week. So that and these other shorter videos about how to safely consume all these different substances, Vice are pumping all of that content out, and either it's already online or it will be going online very soon. And it all ties into this, you know, it's all about education. That's how you save lives. And there's all these different things that the media and promoters and festivals should be doing. We need the support of councils and the police to enable this to happen.
Yes.
So that doing this good stuff then doesn't stop you getting a license for your festival down the line. So there's an element of persuading the police. And there are some police forces out there who totally get this. It really varies around the country. But there are plenty of people in the police who really understand this. And I know there was one anecdote of some police who saw some of the work the Loop were doing or similar schemes. And they were basically saying, we need these people to work for us. Because when we send drugs to get tested through the official channels, it takes 2 weeks to find out. And you're doing it in 5 minutes. This is really, you know, really good stuff. And so we need everybody to sort of get involved in this. And then schemes like this, and the fact it's Festival Republic, obviously part of Live Nation,
yes,
some big festivals, that is very exciting that they are managing to get the powers that be to allow this to happen. And hopefully we see more of this,
yes,
and it will make clubs and festivals and all those music experiences a lot safer.
Yeah, but so going back to The Great Escape, we have referenced a lot about that in this week's podcast. You can read coverage of all of our panels and sessions, interviews, presentations in the CMU Daily on completemusicupdate.com, on something new every day.
Yeah, so a panel a day.
Until we run out.
Yeah, over the next few weeks. There's also some CMU Trends articles coming up, some of which will be based on the presentations I gave on things like royalties and music media and music PR. We will also do a CMU Trends article on actually this drug stuff, which will have some of the stuff on education from the drugs conference. And also we're going to be talking to the guys at The Loop and get a little bit more information about exactly what it is that they're doing. So if you're a premium subscriber, in addition to all those reports in the Daily, look out for a whole series of CMU Trends articles coming out over the coming weeks.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. We'll be back again next week. I think I might be on the phone, but
that's something to look forward to.
I'll work it out to set the levels on the recorder this time.
Third time lucky,
third
as they
time
say.
Lucky, yeah. But yes, look out for us wherever you get your podcast. Make sure you subscribe. The CMU podcast is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7Digital.
It was easy.
Yeah.
I don't know what you were complaining about.